Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your guest host, Grace Wan. On tonight's show, we explore the differences between the male brain and the female brain and why those differences matter. Data is emerging about the role of hormones in brain structure and behavior with surprising implications for our understanding of gender and disease. Why are males more likely to have autism and schizophrenia, while females are more likely to have depression and multiple sclerosis? What are we learning about the roles of nature and nurture in determining behavior? What are the strengths of the female brain? And what are the strengths of the male brain? While our cultural attitudes are broadening about who is male and who is female, tonight we look at sex difference from the perspective of science. I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Dr. Nirao Shah, professor of psychiatry, behavioral sciences, and neurobiology at Stanford University. Welcome, Dr. Shah.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And by phone, I have Dr. Luann Brizendine, psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the School of Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. She is the founder of the UCSF Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic and is the author of the books The Female Brain and The Male Brain. Welcome, Dr. Brizendine.
Hi. Nice to be with you, Grace. And hi, Nirao.
Hi, Luann.
I also have Dr. Larry Cahill on the phone. He's a professor of neurobiology and behavior at the School of Biological Sciences at UC Irvine. Welcome, Dr. Cahill.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Hello to everyone else.
Hi, Larry.
We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. Well, it's such a pleasure to have you all here today with us. And I wanted to start off with each of you by having you explain what some of your research is. And I thought since you're in studio, Nirao, maybe you could start?
Sure. So our research focuses on animal models, basically asking how is it that the brain, which looks essentially similar between male and females at a gross level, makes animals behave differently between the sexes. So we take a molecular genetic approach to identifying differences in gene expression in the brain and asking what these, how these gene expression differences translate into sex differences in behavior.
And how long have you been doing that research?
About 14 years as faculty and several years before that as a postdoctoral fellow at Columbia.
And Luann, I have you on the phone. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what your research is in this area?
Yes, I specialize in human beings because I run the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic. And very specifically, I work with women who come to the clinic who have responses to fluctuations in the female hormones, like during the menstrual cycle or like during postpartum when there are rapid, large changes in progesterone and estrogen in the female body, which also affects the brain. Therefore, my patients usually present with things like mood disorders, anxiety, depression, and other types of psychiatric and mental health issues.
Great. And Larry, you're down at Irvine, I think. Can you tell us a little bit about your research?
Sure. I kind of bridge the animal-human gap. I've worked with both. I got drawn into the sex difference issue about 17 years ago through my work on brain mechanisms of emotional memory, which is something I've studied for about 35 years. And it was about 17 years ago or so, using PET scanning and fMRI, that I discovered that a key brain structure, a little guy called the amygdala, that everybody agrees is important for emotional memory, was acting differently in men and women. And it was that sex difference in the amygdala that drew me into this topic about 17 years ago.
And, Larry, why is it important to study sex differences?
Well, Tim, it's important to study sex differences because they're everywhere affecting everything. They're affecting all levels of brain and body function in ways that are far greater than the medical mainstream has appreciated. And that really that the medical mainstream still appreciates. We're seeing a transformation take place. But if there's one thing that I would hope your listeners would take away from this hour, it's that over the last 20 years in particular, neuroscientists and really medicine generally have discovered that there are sex differences of all sizes and shapes at every level of brain function. And we can't truly treat women equally if we continue to essentially ignore them, which is what we've been doing.
And would you agree with that, Luann, that conventional medical research has been ignoring women in that way?
I think one of the things that usually my students laugh at the most is when they find out that actually, for various and sundry reasons, the birth control pill was first studied on men. But there's lots and lots of medications that, of course, are going to be prescribed to women that are basically tried just on male animals and just on men. And I was recently at one of the most prestigious brain science meetings in the country called the McKnight Neuroscience Meeting in Aspen a couple of weeks ago. And it's very interesting that all of the research that's being presented there at this meeting, again, was being done on male rodents because they don't want the menstrual cycle or the estrous cycle, the fluctuations in hormones in the female, to quote-unquote mess up the data.
Nirao, how about your research on animals? Are you finding that as well, or do you use male and female animal for your experiments?
That's actually the point of our research. We actually work with both males and females and explicitly ask the question, are there differences in gene expression or structure in the brain in very specific locales, like the amygdala, between male and female animals?
And what have you found?
Well, we have found many differences in gene expression in the brain between male and female mice in the hypothalamus, which is essential for all social behaviors. It's important for emotions. It's important for sleep regulation, mood, and other behaviors. And also in the amygdala, which, as Larry mentioned, is sort of the seat of our emotions. So we found widespread sex differences in gene expression in the brain. And these gene expression differences are controlled by circulating sex hormones like testosterone and estrogen. And they control behaviors in a really powerful manner.
You've been in this research for quite some time. Are there changes in technology that have made this research possible that you couldn't have done 14 years ago?
Absolutely. So we could always sort of do genetics in mice. That's one of the advantages of animal models, that you can sort of you can do experiments with them. But recent advances in the last 10 years, some of them pioneered at Stanford with optogenetics, the use of light to sort of activate or silence neurons, or pharmacogenetics, as we call it, the use of very specific chemicals that can inducibly activate or silence specific classes of neurons, really allows us to look at a very specific manner at discrete classes of neurons that control one or the other behaviors without sort of altering the entire activity of related regions.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Can you explain to our listeners, what is a neuron?
A neuron is a cell just like any other cell in the body. It is specialized in the sense that it has a specialized process for receiving information, and then can take this information and generate electrical signals and send it out through a different process called an axon. And these axons and dendrites in the neurons communicate with each other. So you can think of the many neurons in our brain, the human brain or the mouse brain. The mouse brain is about 80 million neurons. They're talking with each other constantly. And a neuron on average makes about 1,000 other connections. So you have basically large patterns of circuits in the brain.
Larry, can you reflect a little bit for our audience about this predisposition to study male subjects versus female and male subjects with medical research?
Sure. I think it's something that has very, very deep roots. I actually study the history of our field, and I've been able to trace it back a good 500 years. Seriously, we have a good 500-year tradition of searching for the fundamental, the most important discoveries. And we have about a 500-year tradition of believing that the fundamental discoveries are the ones we all share. And so sex differences smacks right into the middle of that. I've had colleagues tell me that they would be interested in sex differences, except they're not fundamental, which is ironic, since it's one of the most important aspects of all biology, sex. But what those colleagues are saying is that they think that the fundamental is the shared, and sex differences, by definition, aren't fundamental. Now, it's a little ironic here, because we also have seen in the last 5 years or so, and your viewers have probably heard this, the growth of individualized medicine or personalized medicine. It's almost a mantra in some circles. It's ironic because individualized medicine is all about differences between us. And yet the same people who will tell you how important individualized medicine is or personalized medicine most of the same people will tell you, you don't have to worry about male, female, that's not all that important. And it's because of this deeply, deeply ingrained bias, essentially, which holds that sex differences are not fundamental because they're not shared. I think that's maybe the key reason that has kept this issue marginalized instead of center stage where it should be.
And Luann, when we don't treat the or appreciate the difference, what could happen in terms of medical care for men and women? What are the implications of that?
Well, I think as Larry says, and Larry has pioneered and been a wonderful spokesperson for this view over the years, thank you for that, Larry, is that it's basically very injurious to both males and females if we don't know how to personalize some of the treatments we're going to be giving you. And for example, I think one that's come to light in the last 3 or 4 years has been that the FDA finally, in one medication that's used a lot of your listeners may use Ambien, which is basically a very common sleeping agent. It's a prescription agent, but it was originally released in a dosage, a 10 milligram pill, that was tried out, of course, mostly on males and found to be that was the effective dose for males. And finally, they had so many side effects in the females taking this that the FDA reassessed all of the data in the clinical trials and then reset it to 5 milligrams was the female dose and 10 was the male. And that may sound like a tiny little nothing of a decision by FDA, but this is really one of the most recent but first tweaks to how the physiology, even in metabolism and in the brain function of sleep in males and females, may differ for certain kinds of medications. And of course, we know illnesses like autism is a 4 or 8 to 1 in males, in young males over females, and females, depression and anxiety are in the 2 or 3 to 1 for females. So we have many kinds of very common, as we say in medicine, fundamental illnesses that would be helped greatly if we could understand what the sex difference is and how to treat those individuals specifically.
And I think with the, you referenced the Ambien situation, which I think came to light in about 2014, there was a little bit of study by the FDA that there in animals, there was a male and female animals, there was a little bit of a difference in the reaction to it, but that didn't seem to get much of attention from the FDA until recently. Isn't that right, Larry?
In fact, there was a large difference in the early data about 20 years ago, but that large difference was ignored. Now, I want to be careful here. I don't want to sound like I'm on a high horse. If I was in charge of the FDA 20 years ago, I might have made the same decision because we really didn't have so many reasons to suspect that sex differences were so ubiquitous and important. The problem today is that many people are operating as if it was 20 years ago or 40 years ago, utterly unaware of the enormous amount of data we've produced regarding sex differences. So decisions like what were made about Ambien, as Luann just said, it represents people starting slowly to wake up and realize that we've been assuming that you don't have to really worry fundamentally about sex, and in not worrying about it, we are disproportionately harming women. Bear in mind that women absolutely, clearly, disproportionately bear the brunt of side effects of drugs and medicine. 8 of the 10 drugs that were withdrawn from the market about 10 years ago were withdrawn because they had worse effects in women. So this is not some arcane academic issue. This is an issue which is deeply affecting medical health, especially for women.
And Neerav, as you look at your own research, do you find that you're getting the funding that you need to study sex differences of the brain?
Right. So our funding comes primarily from the NIH, although I should mention, since Luann brought it up, that I did receive funding from the McKnight Foundation to pursue exactly that, you know, research and sort of differences between males and females. So I'm grateful for all the funding sources. And the NIH has been really a wonderful supporter of basic science research. And now, more recently, they also have an initiative really sort of pushing people not necessarily working directly on sex differences to sort of not to sort of force them to reevaluate and think hard before they do not include female subjects in their study. So I think that's a great positive move by the NIH.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about what is different between a male brain and a female brain. Neerav, what do you think about that?
Well, there are at least sort of two major effects of sex hormones. So a lot of the sex differences in the brain in animal models and perhaps in humans as well are set up by sex hormones. And they act early in development to sort of irreversibly at many levels make the brain sort of male or female. And then after puberty, you again have sex hormones coming into the bloodstream, and then they sort of activate these sort of developmental patterns so that the animals can enact adult patterns of male or female behaviors. So you can ask, how do sex hormones act in the brain to control these differences in behavior? And they do that by controlling differences in survival of different classes of neurons. So in some cases, some brain regions have more neurons in males. In other cases, other regions in females have more neurons than in males. And in addition to these sort of survival effects, sex hormones can also tell these neurons where to go. So in the sense that neurons end up communicating with different kinds of neurons. So they set up sex differences in connectivity in the brain.
So you're saying there's a difference in structure in the animals that you look at.
That's right.
And differences in the way the cells communicate to each other.
That's right. And these differences are set up by sex differences in gene expression.
And in your research, you had some fascinating research about mice and taking out some portion of the gene and putting it back in. Can you tell our listeners what happened there?
So I think the study you're referring to is where we identified a large number of differences in gene expression between males and females that were different between the sexes. And these differences were controlled by sex hormones. And when we generated mice, or when we examined mice sort of lacking one of these genes, what we saw was that these males or females had very specific deficits, or they had very specific differences in social interactions. So
like some of the mice mothers, when you took out the gene, what would happen?
So the behaviors we primarily look at are social behaviors. So parental behaviors are sort of a good example of behaviors that are different in mice between the two sexes. So there was a gene that we identified, which if we removed, then the female mothers, when they had pups, would not be as likely to take care of their pups. So they were more liable to lose their pups after birth. Whereas if you removed a different gene, then they were perfectly fine mothers, but they were not necessarily in the mood to sort of engage in mating behavior.
And Luann, in human beings, how does the male brain and the female brain differ in its strengths?
Well, the way that I like to explain it when I'm talking about to an audience is in terms of how they'll say, what's different really, Dr. Brisson, about the male and female brain? I'll say, well, it all begins at the moment of conception. Of course, if you end up with a Y chromosome from the sperm versus an X, you'll be male versus female. And about 8 weeks into fetal life, the tiny testicles in the male start pumping out large amounts of testosterone that through the whole rest of the 9 months, they marinate the brain in testosterone if it's male, changing the brain circuits. And like Nero said, a lot of the genes are turned on, and lots of the setup for what's going to make that brain male is happening. And the female brain is left unperturbed by testosterone for all that time in the human, and is basically the hormones aren't turned on until after birth. So by the time we're all born, we're born with the basic setup of having a male brain or a female brain.
Larry, I'd like to have you pick up on that. What in your research have you seen in terms of how the male brain and the female brain are different?
Well, I'd like to answer your question first on a general level, and then with a specific example I think your listeners may find interesting, which doesn't necessarily relate exactly to my research, although we can come back to that. The first general answer is that males and females differ. They are similar and different in virtually any domain you can think of brain function. Pain perception, sensation of all kinds, depression, anxiety, spatial navigation. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So when you ask the question, how do males and females differ, the answer for those of us who are in the field is there's almost an embarrassment of riches. There's so many sex influences that's they're ubiquitous, and I think that's the first thing your listeners should know. But by way of a specific example that maybe they would find interesting, I think, and as regards the human brain, I think one of the most intriguing sex differences, which has really been forcefully seen now across a whole bunch of human imaging studies, is that as a strong general rule, and remember, none of these things are black and white. They are strong statistical averages like the rest of medicine. But as a strong general rule, the female brain has greater connectivity. We talked about neurons before. Well, those neurons send fibers that talk to one another. There are more fibers going between the hemispheres on average in the female brain than the male brain. Again, that's been seen by a number of different labs over many years. It's a fact. That fact, in turn, fits with a psychological level finding, which has been supported. I can show you reviews from the 70s, 80s, 90s, all supporting the general view that, as a rule, the female brain tends to operate in a way that is more symmetrical across the hemispheres than does the male brain, which conversely tends to operate in a way more asymmetrical across the hemispheres. That fact fits, dovetails perfectly with the anatomical evidence regarding fibers between the hemispheres in recent years. So that's a nice, strong, general example of how one might expect to see differences in, on average, in the functioning of male and female brains.
We're going to get back to that, but let me break in here. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Niraj Shah, Professor of Psychiatry, Behavioral Sciences, and Neurobiology at Stanford University, Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of the books The Female Brain and the Male Brain, and Dr. Larry Cahill, Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the School of Biological Sciences at UC Irvine. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call in to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. It seems that the research shows that there's a difference between the male and the female brain structurally and how it connects. And yet there seems to be also a little bit of resistance to that research that you've seen in the press. Larry, can you touch upon that a little bit?
Sure. There absolutely is resistance from some corners, and I have written about what I think is the main source of this resistance. And I, to cut to the chase, I think it boils down to a deeply, deeply ingrained, powerful and implicit assumption that equal has to mean the same. And therefore, that if a neuroscientist, and that's a false assumption, and therefore if a neuroscientist shows that males and females, be they mice or rats or monkeys or humans, are not the same in some aspect of brain function, then that neuroscientist is showing that they are not equal, and that is false. But I think the heart of the resistance that keeps occurring, especially as the issue has been growing, it's been exploding in the last 5 to 10 years as more and more people are looking for sex differences and finding them as they must. I think the heightened resistance has its root in this false assumption that I encourage people to think about and abandon if they hold it, that equal means the same.
Mm-hmm. And Luann, we touched a little bit about the higher incidence of certain diseases in women than in men and vice versa. Could you talk a little bit about that and how that might be a reflection of how the brains are different?
I think what's interesting to know for your audience is that let's look at the disease with a large disease called depression. Of course, that's probably many diseases all poured into kind of one bucket, but the disease depression, in childhood, the ratio is 1-to-1, boys to girls. And not until puberty does it split. At about 13, 14, 15 years old, the female starts to have more and more incidence of depression, and the male stays about the same. So we know that also then the ratio goes back to close to 1-to-1 at menopause. So something about the menstrual cycle and the fluctuations of those hormones are doing something to all that different sort of specific circuitry in the female brain that leads to mood disorders. And some hypotheses are that because females, we are the ones who are mostly responsible for keeping helpless infants alive, we are supposed to have a more tuned system to helping keep helpless infants and nonverbal infants for up to 2 years old alive, so that it may have something to do with sort of tuning our emotional and mood systems that predisposes the female brain to having more depression, for example. And then, of course, the one area in psychology that's known the best to have the highest male-to-female ratio is not in the area of anger or feelings of anger. Anger is about 1-to-1 in males and females, but the area of physical aggression in males is about 20-to-1, and that is the most robust difference in terms of the behavioral aggression in males over females, and lots of that is laid at the feet of the hormone testosterone. Of course, that doesn't start to rise between ages of 9 years old and 15 in boys. That goes up like about times 250. So it's a very large, steep increase during adolescence. So those are the kinds of things I think about in my area with humans that have to do with behavioral manifestations of the sex hormones playing out on all of the brain circuitry of the male brain or the female brain. Of course, we don't want to leave out the area of being gender fluid or areas that are not as specifically in a male bucket or female bucket, which is an area of research that's just beginning.
Yeah, and Narao, in your research, how do those hormones that Luann was referring to, how do they affect the brain during those times with mice and the animals that you work on? What's happening with the hormones inside the brain such that the behavior is changing?
Right. So at least in one instance, we have a very direct link. So I already mentioned, right, so we have identified many genes whose expression in the brain is controlled by sex hormones. And so these genes, their expression differs between males and females. And in one case, we actually identified a gene whose expression actually cycles across the female cycle.
Huh.
So it peaks when the female is ovulating, you know, suggesting that it's getting the female ready mm-hmm. to be mating. And that's exactly what happens when we remove this gene. The females are not that interested in mating anymore,
interesting.
Even though they might be ovulating. So sort of going back to, so I'd like to touch a little bit on what Larry and Luann just said. Some of the genes that we've identified as being different between males and females, you know, in sort of basic fundamental research, actually we've shown or we've sort of seen now that these genes have been linked to human conditions that are also different between males and females, boys and girls, men and women. So we've identified genes that are different in health in mice that have been linked by human association studies with diseases that are different between in the human population, alcoholism being one of them. And
how does that, your example of alcoholism, how does that change between men and women? What's the difference there?
It's much more common in men than in women.
And why would that be? Because of the use of, because of the hormone, because the gene expression?
The why question is a hard one to answer. We don't know why they're predisposed, but the mechanisms are going to be sort of gene expression difference based, right? So you have genes that are controlled by sex hormones that are different between men and women, or at least male and female mice, that might translate into the male or female brain being more or less susceptible or more or less resilient to specific environmental stressors or to specific disease sort of triggering agents. So you have differences in disease.
And you mentioned alcoholism. I've seen that the autism is another area where there seems to be a difference in male and female presentation of autism. And have you seen that in your research?
Right. So we've also identified genes that have been linked that are sort of different between male and female mice, but in human studies have been shown to be linked to specific cases of autism. And surprisingly, we've also identified gene differences in the brain in mice that are regulated by sex hormones that are also known to be sort of important for breast cancer and also to sort of cause a maldevelopment of penis, for example, in humans,
mm-hmm.
right? So these genes that are regulated by sex hormones in the brain might also be regulating sort of peripheral reproductive physiology, such as breast function and also sort of urogenital development.
It seems like this is an area of medical research that's exploding. It's always kind of been around, but it's becoming more robust. Larry, what are some of the other areas of research that are happening that are kind of pushing this to a different horizon?
First, there has been, as we've talked about, the explosion on the genetic level. When people see sex differences in the genetic level in things like how cells die in petri dishes, you know, there's actually sex differences in how cells die in petri dishes, it really forces people to wake up and think about what's going on here. But I think the other big area that's been driving this is the same thing that drew me into it 17 or 18 years ago, which is PET scanning and fMRI. Remember that in animal research, to this day, neuroscientists use roughly 90% male animals. So that means most of the animal research is not really in a position to discover sex differences. However, when you go to the human, like I did about 18 years ago, you naturally start to study this thing called the female. When I did PET scanning and fMRI for the first time, I was studying females for the first time in my career. And it was because I was simply studying females that I was in a position to discover what I mentioned at the top of the program, this difference regarding this critical emotional memory structure called the amygdala. And for me, it's all followed from that. So the more people are studying both the male and female in the human, and then the more they're allowing themselves to be open to the possibility that there's sex differences there, they're sort of dropping their resistance to it, the more people will continue to make discoveries. In my case, regarding emotional memory, it is a fact that all the anxiety disorders, all of them, heavily disproportionately affect women compared to men. And neuroscientists really have no idea why, because basically they've been ignoring that fact. My own research over the last 17 years or so has been suggesting that something about this differential amygdala response, perhaps relating to a heightened memory for details of emotional events in women. We have evidence regarding sex hormone-driven enhancements in detail memory in women after emotional events. This may help explain why women disproportionately suffer from all anxiety disorders.
I'd love to get back to that, but first let me say this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Nirav Shah, Professor of Psychiatry, Behavioral Sciences, and Neurobiology at Stanford University, Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of the books The Female Brain and the Male Brain, and Dr. Larry Cahill, Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the School of Biological Sciences at UC Irvine. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on your Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Larry, before that break, you were talking about how women experience emotions in a different way and that anxiety disorders disproportionately affect women. How has your research borne that out, and how did you discover that through your research?
Clinical fact that women disproportionately, 2 to 3 to 1, suffer all anxiety disorders more than men, that was already known. What happened in my research was I was sort of going along with my assumption that sex doesn't matter, and then I stumbled upon a sex difference on what everybody agrees is the single most important structure in the brain for emotion and emotional memory, this little amygdala. And so, of course, we came to a fork in the road, and the one side said explain this away, and the other side said explain it, and we chose to try and explain it. What we think we've uncovered in the last 15 or so years of research is that in women, in particular naturally cycling women, when they're at the high hormone second phase of their cycle, there is, for reasons we still don't understand, a heightened propensity for women to remember the details, in particular, of negative emotional events. They lock in them more. They ruminate on them more. We actually found a correlation between the amount of the sex hormone progesterone in their saliva and how much they ruminate on negative events. And we think this is all connected with somehow that old left hemisphere amygdala I told you about at the beginning. We think that somehow all this works together in a woman, a naturally cycling woman, during and after negative emotional events to help drive those events into her memory, meaning she's at a much greater susceptibility for negative consequences from those emotional events, namely the anxiety disorders. So that's the essence of what we think we've uncovered in the last 10 to 15 years.
And Luann, in your book, The Female Brain, you talk a lot about those differences, the emotional, behavioral differences. Can you comment on Larry's research?
Yeah, I think Larry's research is very interesting and helps to try to at least move us in the direction of understanding possibly some of the foundations of what we see in the clinic, which is 2 to 3 to 1 anxiety disorder and mood disorders in women that are particularly related to menstrual cycle fluctuations because if you block the menstrual cycle, you can actually, in females, end up taking away some of that fluctuation in the anxiety or the mood disorder. And also with the postpartum depression, where you have a 20 or 30 times change after delivering a baby in a big crash in all of the hormones, a certain number of women that are susceptible to that, up to 20% of women will have some mood changes after that huge change in female hormones. It's not just, of course, estrogen and progesterone, since we have, you know, the hormone oxytocin that is very well known is quite prevalent in females and fluctuates throughout the cycle and is stimulated by estrogen. So we do know that, you know, oxytocin helps you have a lot of things that are remembering aspects of the emotional events and remembering aspects of things that are meaningful and emotional with your infant or with your child. So there's there are more hormones than just, of course, the estrogen progesterone story. But indeed, this area of trying to figure out why and what the foundation is of the increased mood disorders and where it happens in the brain and how we might be able to ameliorate some of that. And of course, one of the ways we, for the last 25 years, have been able to help women with these fluctuating anxiety and mood disorders is we can do things like decrease the fluctuation in the menstrual cycle by putting women on what's called continuous hormones, like continuous birth control pills, or we can block the hormone cycle altogether in women that have very severe mood issues that come up with bad postpartum depression or premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Those are the types of disorders that happen in about 8% of women will have that at some point in their life. So these are frequent problems and can be addressed by changing the hormones. Or another area that we found serendipitously here at UCSF with my colleague Cindy Mellon, who was able to find out that the SSRIs, those are the drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Lexapro, all of the SSRIs actually change some of the metabolism of progesterone in the female brain. So you can give those at the end of the menstrual cycle, and it kind of blocks some of the changes in the hormone metabolism in the brain. So we've learned ways to try to help women be less depressed or less anxious with changes in the menstrual cycle. 20% of women, of course, we should say, don't have any of those changes. They don't. Right. They don't have any of this. So about 20% don't. 80% will have some at some point in their life, and 20% of women will suffer more deeply from some of those. So
it's fascinating. We have a caller on the line. Sally from Oakland, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wondering, since there's so much, you know, the factual level of transgender in this country and people who are sort of identifying on various spectrums. I imagine there's a whole fluctuation between male and female having different hormones in their body. I know my father had a lot of female hormones with his prostate cancer treatment. How do you really know the brain that you're working on necessarily has that hormone balance? And are there studies with the transgender population in the same subject?
Luann, would you like to
take
that?
Yeah, well, the thing we know, thank you, Seth. It's a very interesting question, and you've touched on an area that we wish we knew a lot more about than we do. I mean, we know that, you know, about it's either between a 1 in 100 or 1 in 300 people do identify as transgender in the United States. So it's not infrequent. And we don't know that much about what the why is for that in any individual. But we do know that usually the hormone levels of someone who feels that they are female and yet they have male chromosomes and they have high levels of male testosterone, they may still feel that they are identified as female. So we do know that it's not related to your absolute hormone level in any kind of way. So that's part that we know about. I mean, maybe Neuro and Larry know something more about anything that has to do with genetics, that any road we've gone down in different areas of the brain. We looked at that in the 1990s, and some of the things we thought we knew have come to not be so as we've done more research over the past 15 or 20 years. So the honest truth is right now we don't understand very much about it from that point of view. But maybe Larry and Nira have some other ideas.
Larry?
Well, I would jump in here and say that I think her question was, to what extent does the existence of transgender people influence the research on the mainstream of the research? Luann, you already pointed out that the overall number of such people is relatively small, such that it's doubtful that many of the studies we've been referring to over this hour have had many or any of transgender people in the populations. I think it's also important to point out in this context, you hear a lot of talk lately about how gender is not binary. And that, in fact, is true, and it's something that scientists have known since roughly the 1960s. So there's nothing new there. It is, however, and this is the part that gets left out of a lot of conversations, it is, however, highly bimodal. That means there's two large groups of people on either end of the distribution, extremely large, comprising about 96% of the population. And then there's a small group of people in the middle who are more of a mix. And so I think it's just important for people to keep in mind that while it is not binary, it is highly bimodal. And the push of most of us regarding sex differences is to, at least for now, maintain the focus on that almost half the population, that one half of the bimodal population that has been vastly underserved, called women.
And what have you seen in your research on this topic, Niral?
So I'd just like to go back to the human studies and maybe see what Luann and Larry have to say about it. There was one study published in the mid-90s with a small sample size, because it's a human study, by Dick Swab, and they showed that in transsexuals, there were sort of discrete changes in a particular brain region that correlated with the transition to the transgender identity. That is hard to study in mice because you can't, or animal models, because you just can't ask animals, well, are you male or female? Do you identify with your sex or not? So that's a hard question to ask. What I can say is that we, in animal models, we can tease apart genetically or with other experiments different aspects of maleness or femaleness. So if you will, we can sort of take apart, you know, mothering behavior or sexual behavior or male aggression, for example, from male sexual behavior. We can disentangle the different components that go into making a typical male or a typical female, if there is such a thing.
Luann, what do you think about that?
I'm just going to say that that study, that those studies from Swab back from the studies that he did of the transgender population, and he followed them before for 2 years before they took the opposite sex's hormones and went in that direction, and basically did lots of neuropsych testing, finding how verbal, how much libido, how much sex drive, how much mathematical skills, and tried to do all the things that were thought in those days to be different. And then once the person started taking the other sex's hormones to start their transition, started doing neuropsych testing on them yet again after 2 years after taking the hormones, and found some differences, that the males, the ones that had gone towards the male taking more testosterone, became obviously much more sexual and higher libido, but also had lower interest in verbal things. And it was a little bit, it's been questioned a bit, but it has some very interesting findings that are still being looked at. I don't know if Larry knows about those anymore in terms of Schwab's work.
No, I really don't. What I think your listeners can take home with them, or maybe they already are home, what they can have to remember is that nobody knows what it is that causes the phenomenon that I think is formally known as gender dysphoria, according to the DSM. Nobody knows. We can pretty powerfully say what doesn't cause it, or what can't be the primary answer, and that is culture. Because if you consider cases like the most famous case now of Caitlyn Jenner, here's a case where every cultural force for this person's entire life tried to convince this person that they were male, and it all failed. So while nobody knows what the biological explanations are for what people typically call transgender individuals, we can pretty confidently say what can't be the explanation, and that is human cultural explanations.
That's really interesting. We're here talking about the female brain and the male brain from a scientific perspective. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Dr. Nirav Shah, Professor of Psychiatry, Behavioral Sciences, and Neurobiology at Stanford University, Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of the books The Female Brain and The Male Brain, and Dr. Larry Cahill, Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the School of Biological Sciences at UC Irvine. We invite you to call in with your questions or your comments. To call in, join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So we were talking about transgender before the break, and I'd like to shift a little bit to male and female behaviors that you might have been seeing in your work, Dr. Shah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the behaviors we work on in our animal models are primarily social behaviors, because those are the ones that are sort of innately wired in, where experience doesn't matter that much. You can take a male or a female and expose them to the right conditions, and they naturally, without any prior learning, engage in the behaviors. So parental behaviors, maternal behaviors, for example, or male aggression. Male mice, for example, are naturally territorial. And if they see another male in the territory, they will attack the male. But if they see a female, then they'll attempt to mate with a female. So these behaviors are sort of genetically wired in, or at least developmentally wired in, by sex hormone exposures that we all talked about earlier. So these are the behaviors we work on, and sort of circling back to the transgender question, the region that Dick Swab identified as being different in the transgender is sort of changing with identity, is conserved in animals, right? So you do find the same structure, which is related to the amygdala that Larry's been talking about. So one could focus on these regions, and people have worked on this region in animals, and it is important for sexual behavior. Right, and it is concentrated in receptors for sex hormones, such as testosterone and estrogen. So one way we go about with our studies is we ask, well, these neurons express a receptor or a gene that is responsive to a sex hormone. How do we then sort of figure out what these neurons are doing? So we use genetic tricks to sort of activate the neurons or silence the neurons and ask, well, what is the function of these neurons in the adult animal as the animal is going about his or her own business?
We have a call from Mike in San Francisco. You had a question for our panel?
Yes, I do. You touched on it earlier. I don't remember which member of the panel did, about the sexual difference regarding MS. I wonder if somebody could also elaborate a little bit more on what you know about that. And a related thing is that there's been some findings regarding MS and mono. And I guess my related question would be, is mono also more prevalent in women than in men?
Larry, would you like to take that question about multiple sclerosis and the higher incidence of that particular disease among women?
Expert on this particular area, but it is definitely the case that there are sex differences in the incidence of multiple sclerosis, with women tending to be more likely to get it than men. On the other hand, if I am remembering the data correctly, when men get it, it tends to be worse. It is a worse thing to get, so that's essentially two sex differences right there. If you ask the question why, which is the most important question, and look into the literature, you'll get this grab bag of intriguing possible explanations, but no overall satisfying explanation. And again, it's because, like everything else in this conversation, medicine overwhelmingly has ignored the issue. So, for example, there's a little peptide called galanin, and this little peptide is important in our friend the amygdala, which keeps popping up. And there's some investigators in Russia which have shown pretty convincingly in humans that this little peptide galenin plays a very different role in getting multiple sclerosis in men and women. That's the kind of snippet, essentially, that you'll get a lot of if you look into the multiple sclerosis literature, enough to absolutely convince you that there are sex differences we need to be paying attention to, but not enough to give you a satisfying overall answer at this stage. I hope as medicine continues to wake up, we will, in 5 to 10 years, you know, be able to give much more satisfying answers to good questions like that.
We have another call from...
The two other illnesses, Parkinson's disease is slightly more prevalent in males, and then, of course, Alzheimer's, late-onset Alzheimer's disease is slightly more prevalent in female brains.
And it seems like we should be doing some more research on that. We have a call from Brock.
Yes, hello.
Hi. You have a question for our panel?
Yes, I wanted to return back to the conversation of emotional working memory. And it seems to me like for a while, if we could, how we diagnose or look for ADHD is essentially working memory. And my experience with borderline people and some more of the subtle personality disorders, it could actually be an inability to remember what they put out emotionally and what's given back to them emotionally. And I don't know, it has always seemed like it might be more of a subtle disconnect of being able to remember emotional context. And I was wondering if any of your panel could speak to that more.
Larry, I think you've done a lot of research on that. Would you like to take that question?
Well, that's actually a very intriguing question, and I congratulate you for raising a question that I don't think I can think of a single paper that's directly addressed.
I think you have a new research project, Larry.
So that's very good. It may well be that there is some relatively subtle difference in, as you put it, some sort of emotional disconnect that disproportionately affects one sex over the other. That can help explain something like ADHD. It's such a good idea, and I'm literally sitting here scanning my brain, unable to think of a single study that has directly addressed that or even raised it. So I wish I had a more satisfying answer, but thank you for the question.
Yeah, Narelle.
And ADHD is also much more common in boys than it is in girls. It is also hugely sexually dimorphic, so it is, you know, the incidence is much, much more higher in boys and girls.
Yeah. We have another call on the line. Ed from Menlo Park. Are you there, Ed?
Good evening. I'm aging now. I'm 64, and I'm wondering, as men and women age, especially women, their hormone levels drop, but men's hormone levels drop, do we become more alike?
Do we become more alike as we age and the hormones drop? Luann?
Well, I'll take a piece of that one since we've done some work in that area. And if you take a 60-year-old male and a 60-year-old female, given that the female is not having any hormone replacement, or neither one of them is, in the male brain at 60 years old, he has at least 4 times more estrogen in his brain than the 60-year-old female does, because testicles are still making plenty of testosterone, and in the various parts of the body, including the brain, we have a really nice enzyme called aromatase. It sounds like a coffee bean, but it's not a coffee bean. It's called aromatase, and it's the one that changes testosterone into estrogen. So, you know, there are a lot of differences in aging, and your caller has an interesting point to make, and that actually there a lot of people in the field will often joke that the males are becoming more like females after the age of 60 because they have much more estrogen in their brain than the female.
Could I jump in on that?
Yeah, Larry.
By saying, first of all, as a pretty strong general rule, the sex differences gradually decline as people get older. It's a pretty safe general rule. But I would also take this opportunity to note we've pretty much heavily talked about hormone effects throughout this conversation, and while they are very, very important, another big lesson of the last 15 years is there are very important non-hormonal genetic explanations of sex differences as well, and medicine is just now starting to crack that whole thing open.
And you're talking about cracking that open. Can you give us a little peek into that?
Well, for example, on the mouse level, they've developed a technique, a very powerful technique, where they can manipulate the part of the Y chromosome that makes the testes, and in so doing, they can create XX males and XY females. And in being able to do this, I'll skip the details, but in being able to create XX males and XY females, they're able to disentangle when is it that the hormones are causing some effect on the brain, and when is it that the genes are causing some effect on the brain. So that's a kind of work that's really being driven heavily in mouse models now.
Are you finding that, Neural?
No, we're not examining the effects of sex chromosome per se on behaviors yet.
Mm-hmm. But is that a promising area of research, do you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a lot of people are working on that problem as to which component, which genes on X chromosome or Y chromosome might be mediating hormone-independent effects mm-hmm. on sex differences and behavior.
We were talking earlier about how medical medicine has been tested on and geared towards men. And as a woman, how worried should I be when I take a particular type of over-the-counter medication or drugs, knowing that it hasn't really been tested on women as much as it's been tested on men? Should I be concerned?
If I can jump in, I have a pretty good answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the FDA website, and for almost any approved drug, you can get the essentials on how the testing was done. And what you're going to find is a mixed bag. You're going to find for some drugs, there's pretty darn good evidence that the drug probably has roughly equal effects in men and women. On the other hand, you're going to find a lot of cases where the testing was done mostly or exclusively in males, and where basically people don't know. So the first and quickest thing I think anybody could do is go to the FDA website, find the page regarding the drug you're interested in, and take a look at their summary information. And the next thing I would do is I would ask my doctor, has this treatment or drug been carefully tested in males and females? Unfortunately, the answer from your doctor is going to be yes. But you can then at least you've started the conversation. So I don't think worried is the right word, but having your eyes open is a better way to, I think about it.
Being discerning, right, Larry? Being discerning and doing some of your homework.
Correct.
And as in this field, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more research done in this area. And I'm going to give you, Dr. Shaw, since you've been doing the animal modeling, what's the next thing for you? What's the next big experiment in your field?
So I think I'm going to sort of resonate with Larry here and Luann as well. I think we sort of vastly underestimate the sort of sex differences in the brain. I think it's barely scratching the surface. So I think there's going to be an enormous number of genes that are going to be different between males and females. And with newer advances in sequencing, so we have new sequencing technologies that are coming online that really let you look in a very fine-grained way at sex differences. These are going to identify many, many more differences between males and females. And this will be great in terms of tying this back to basic behavior as well as sort of relevance to disease.
And we'll have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating evening. That's City Visions for tonight. Our guests have been Dr. Neural Shah, Professor of Psychiatry, Behavioral Sciences, and Neurobiology at Stanford, Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of the books Female Brain and Male Brain, and Dr. Larry Cahill, Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the School of Biological Sciences at UC Irvine. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions show to let us know what you thought about tonight, please go to our webpage at klw.org. Our engineer this evening has been David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join our host Ethan Elkind next week as he explores the ethical and legal implications of gene editing. This has been your guest host, Grace Wan. Thank you for listening. Good night and have a great week.